You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Becoming a new mother is a life-altering experience for many, but navigating pregnancy, birth, and childcare when you don't have access to stable housing, well, that is a challenge no one should have to endure. Every day, plenty of folks in Los Angeles do just that, though, and a new series from the Los Angeles Times looks at what it's like to be unhoused and pregnant in Hollywood through the eyes of young mother Mackenzie Trahan. Reporter Gail Holland, videographer Claire Hannah Collins, and photographer Christina House spent years getting to know Mackenzie, her mother, Kat, and her caseworker, Leslie, as they followed her emotional journey to secure housing and stay connected with her daughter, Anne.
Oh, God. They're going to take everything from me, bro. Like, dude, I did everything they asked me to do, man. And he f***ed up my housing voucher. She waited 3 weeks to tell me, dude. So I was frustrated. So I stopped answering the phone and then they took my daughter because of this shit.
It is a heartbreaking and compelling story. I want to welcome you both, Gail Holland and Claire Hannah Collins, to talk about the story of Mackenzie and their time reporting it. Thank you so much for joining us, Gail and Claire.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Claire, I'll start with you. You were a newcomer to LA when you became curious about the experiences of unhoused pregnant women, a topic that the Times apparently had never really covered before. Why do you think this was important to look into?
That's right. Yeah, I had moved to LA less than a year before when I asked this question of what happens to people who become pregnant while living on the streets. And being a young woman, I think that's just always a possibility of how drastically it can change your life to have a pregnancy, especially an unplanned pregnancy. And so I recognized that the situation of becoming pregnant while living on the streets would come with really unique barriers. And I was just curious what kind of resources were available for people in that situation.
How did Mackenzie's journey, Claire, become the focus of this piece?
Well, we teamed up with Gail, myself, and another videographer at the time. We started doing research on this. And we started by reaching out to a number of different organizations, mostly nonprofits that work specifically with unhoused pregnant women. But we wanted to focus ideally on someone who was actually at the beginning of the journey, who had not yet been plugged into social services. But how we got in touch with Mackenzie was actually kind of a serendipitous thing. And I'll let Gail tell that story.
So Mackenzie's mother called me because Mackenzie had all her belongings, including her tent and bedding and prenatal vitamins, removed in a CHP sweep of her encampment, which was on a dirt embankment overlooking the Hollywood freeway. So I told Claire, and she and Christina House, the still photographer on the project, were able to go right away and make a connection with Mackenzie.
I want to ask you, why is a pregnant woman named Mackenzie sleeping on a dirt bank, you know, overlooking the Hollywood freeway? She is with child, right? And
correct.
There are homeless workers. I mean, how does that happen? Is it a matter of choice? Is it a matter of circumstance? Is it a matter of falling through the cracks? How does that happen?
Until recently, LA didn't really have a significant number of outreach workers to go out and find these people. Mackenzie had been living on the streets of Hollywood on and off since she was 13. And at this time, she was 22. She was very torn about what to do about the pregnancy. So she was dealing with all those problems. In addition to simply being pregnant, I too am shocked. I am shocked that there would not be some kind of a medical team or some kind of a social service presence that would immediately find out that somebody was pregnant and make sure they got inside. But that's not really how it happens. In order to get housing, you have to go through a process. And there's a lot of rules and regulations and bureaucracy. So we just don't have a system that springs into action because there's a 22-year-old woman who's 6.5 months pregnant besides the freeway.
I do want to talk more about the fact that in your piece, you do note that unhoused young women are nearly 5 times more likely to become pregnant than those who are housed. They're also more likely to have repeat pregnancies. Why is that?
Well, again, there's a lot of reasons. The chaos of homeless life, if you haven't spent time in a camp, is kind of hard to even get your head around. And there's not a lot of planning that goes on. There's a lot of minute-to-minute, hour-to-hour survival tactics. And so planning of any kind, including reproductive, is not common. There are reasons that women end up homeless that are related to being pregnant, like a family asks them to leave or a boyfriend, you know, breaks up with them because he doesn't want any responsibility. One of the biggest reasons I heard from several people, though, was that a lot of people, and Mackenzie was one of them, had very troubled upbringings, were in the foster care system, and the idea of having a child it's something that is perfect in and of itself. When a baby is born, it could erase, in their minds, it could erase the troubled domestic history that they had and become a whole new way to have a family that doesn't reflect any of the trauma and tragedy that they experienced as a child.
Claire, all three of the reporters who worked on this series had some unique connections with its subjects, Mackenzie and her mom, Kat. Did this help you, and Gail, I'll ask you as well, but let's start with Claire. Did this help you develop a deeper sense of trust with them?
I think for sure. So the connections you're talking about, Mackenzie and I are almost the exact same age. I'm about 6 months older than her. Christina House, our photographer, was pregnant at the same time as Mackenzie. Their pregnancies overlapped for a couple months. And Gail is about the same age as Mackenzie's mom. I definitely felt a really quick sense of rapport with Mackenzie. I think when she found out that we were the same age, that was a big point of connection for her as well, that I could just relate more personally to her stage of life and the kinds of friendships she had and the things that she was interested in.
And Gail, you with Kat, right?
Yeah, I'm actually older than Kat, but, you know, we had generational connections. Like when she talked about bands that she liked or dancing, they were experiences I had too. And I just enjoyed her sense of humor. You know, there were times, of course, we maintained a distance as reporters, but this was a very intimate reporting experience. And, you know, we were trying to understand their lives by being there for key moments as much as we could and trying to allow them to kind of define their own narrative. So, yeah, it helped. I think it definitely helped.
Mackenzie gives birth to Anne, her baby. But her journey as a mother was a particularly difficult one. Even just, you know, getting a ride to the doctor's appointment was tough, right? I mean, what did you learn, Gail, about the challenges that unhoused pregnant women and mothers face?
Well, I mean, you know, by the time she was, I think, even by the time she was about 8 months pregnant, she hadn't received any prenatal care. And again, it just seems like such a huge hole in the in our medical care system. But I think that the heart of our story, as I saw, was after she actually got help and was placed in a transitional living program with very caring, skilled people from one of the top agencies in LA. And still the hurdles that she had to cross were so difficult. You know, the situation was that in order to move into housing, she had to very quickly find work. She was isolated from all her friends. Those things, I think, were hard on her. And then she had to do all the things that one does when you're in the homeless service system that are all directed or designed to help you. And they certainly do, but they also eat up a lot of time. And for her, there were parts of it that felt, I think, very difficult to do all those things at the same time.
Well, difficult and also, again, heartbreaking, because eventually Mackenzie was charged with neglect and Anne, her baby, was taken away from her and placed in a foster home, which, by the way, was what happened to her, right? And Kat, her mom, was also on the street. What was it like, Gail, to see this happen after getting to, and I'll ask you as well, Claire, getting to know Mackenzie so well and being there for many of Anne's milestones, what was it like to watch that?
It was devastating for us, and I think, and because, of course, we had also known her daughter for the amount of time we were covering this. And the speed and the suddenness, from my point of view, not understanding that this is where things were heading, was very shocking and very difficult. But of course, it was nothing on what Mackenzie was experiencing.
Yeah. I mean, the amount of time and access that we were given and working on this story was really a wonderful gift. We were there for, you know, when Mackenzie got her first ultrasound, letting her know that she was having a baby girl. And we happened to be there the day that Anne said mama for the first time.
Oh, wow.
So, of course, that affects you personally and emotionally. This was like one of the first times that I was getting to be so close to the process of a baby starting to grow up. So it was hugely devastating and depressing. And I completely agree with Gail. And that, you know, what we were experiencing was just the tiniest fraction of what the tragedy that Mackenzie was going through.
How is she doing now, Claire?
We just saw her a few days ago, and she's really excited to have her story out there. And I think she's so brave and incredible for wanting to share this so personal story with the world. And I think she's feeling really good about that.
You write in your piece, and this struck me, for young women with backgrounds like Mackenzie's, homelessness and motherhood are often less a decision than a destiny. Why is it a destiny? Does it have to be a destiny? Can the cycle be broken?
Intergenerational poverty is that manifests as homelessness in particular. It's a very difficult cycle. I mean, poverty in general in the United States, if you look at any studies, it's the cycle continues. And of course, Mackenzie, having become homeless and in the foster care system at a young age, she never received the education that helps a lot of people break out of the, you know, the handcuffs of their initial upbringing. I personally will not be surprised, however, what Mackenzie does, because I think she has a tremendous amount of energy, drive, and talent, and I definitely wouldn't write her off. She already has achieved stable housing and a stable partnership. So those are two big milestones that she's achieved since this all happened.
It is a powerful story. I just want to thank you both. LA Times reporter Gail Holland and videographer Claire Hannah Collins. Thanks for coming on and talking about this important series. Again, a link at the website, kcrw.com/GLA. Thanks to you both.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Yeah, thank you.
Straight ahead, the UN called domestic violence a shadow pandemic at the height of COVID. But is that accurate? How do you look at the numbers, and how can you prevent, identify, and help those who are in need? That's coming up after this short break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now. at kcrw.com/cars.
It's Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. The pandemic brought many unexpected consequences to society. As the COVID lockdown began in 2020, stress at home climbed, as did the rate of domestic violence. And when all the messages were to stay at home to stop the spread of the virus, well, the people experiencing that violence behind closed doors had nowhere else to go. Shelters, indeed, across Southern California were mostly full. Last year, the UN declared this rise in domestic violence a shadow pandemic. Well, Eve Sheedy spent decades at the local and county level working with public agencies on domestic violence policy and prevention. Now she has her own firm called Sheedy Consulting. Eve, thank you so much for coming on. Welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Before your recent retirement, you were the executive director of the LA County Domestic Violence Council. You were there at the beginning of the pandemic, March of 2020. How much did it exacerbate what was going on?
The numbers of hotline calls increased sort of over time as the pandemic continued. However, we were also in touch with law enforcement and other agencies throughout the county, and we got a lot of data from LAPD, and they did not see a big increase. People who run hotlines, and in California, the state requires shelter-based agencies to have hotlines, and those numbers increased.
When you say that, you said calls to the hotline or hotlines about domestic violence increased, but not necessarily formal inquiries or formal complaints, right, at the law enforcement level. What do you think that means? What's going on there?
It's actually quite a difficult thing to determine. A lot of times, survivors who are not subject to physical violence may not identify themselves as victims of domestic violence, or they may not report anything because they feel that in order to report anything, whether it be to a hotline or to the police, they have to have some level of physical violence. So I think it's possible that throughout the pandemic, which, you know, is ongoing, but in the worst part of the pandemic during the lockdown and so forth, that maybe it was an increase in the severity of domestic violence. And I did hear that quite often from providers throughout the county.
The UN calls this a shadow pandemic. Do you think that's wrong? Do you think it's a more nuanced situation?
No, I don't think that's wrong, but I think it's a shadow pandemic that's been going on for many, many, many decades. I think that part of the issue is when you talk about just a rise without further defining it, you've got to be basing that on an assumption that anyone can turn into an abuser. And the reality is domestic violence is about power and control. It's not just about, you know, was there an aberration in your conduct that caused you to, in one instance in your whole life, to become physically violent? Domestic violence is a whole pattern of conduct that's designed to control another human being.
And in the case of, you know, people staying at home during the early, certainly during the early days of the pandemic, then you have, you know, there's no real reprieve, right? You don't go to work, or you're working from home. You're certainly cohabitating with other folks at the home level for hours upon hours of the day without leaving. Is that, do you think, a part of this?
I think it can be. It's important to understand that even prior to the pandemic, isolation is a marker and something that occurs in domestic violence relationships. People who are abusive to their partners will separate them from their family, from their friends, and so forth. So very often, survivors are already isolated at home. They may not be trapped at home, you know, as we were during the pandemic. And I agree that the more hours people who are in a domestic violence relationship spend together, the more it may become more and more stressful. I think there were a number of stresses that exist even, you know, certainly now as well. There's economic stress and so forth. People were losing their jobs, losing their paychecks. And there was the uncertainty of even everybody's own personal health. So I do think levels of stress went up. But again, did that turn people into batterers? I don't think so. I think it ratcheted up those who may have already been abusive. And understand, before the pandemic, we went in at 1 in 4 women, 1 in 7 men, and higher numbers in the LGBTQ community. So we were talking about a very large population to begin with.
I think we would be remiss if we didn't mention the number, right? If somebody's listening to this and needs help, where do they call?
Well, the easiest thing for someone to do is to call the national hotline, 1-800-799-SAFE. And, you know, honestly, if you type into Google domestic violence hotline Los Angeles, you will get a number of agencies, all of whose hotline numbers will come up.
Where do you think LA and California is lacking in dealing with domestic violence? Is there a place, you know, from a policy perspective, but also from sheer tools available for somebody to get help? I mean, do you think it is lacking, and in what ways?
Well, domestic violence suffers, like the rest of LA, with a lack of housing, right? So we have, give or take, about 1,200 shelter beds in a county, and that's emergency and what's called transitional county of 10.5 million people. We need a lot more than 1,200 beds, right? Then we have some survivors who are engaged in housing programs where there may be funding for them to get housing, but there's no housing. So we suffer in that regard, like many, many social services throughout the county. One of the big problems with domestic violence, it is truly underfunded. The state gives $20.6 million to 200 agencies. And I will tell you, I've been in this field a long time. That number has stayed at 20.6 for at least a decade, probably longer. That means no inflation, no increase due to a rise in minimum wage for staff or anything. So that is woefully inadequate, particularly for the number of people who are impacted. And then finally, I would say the domestic violence field here is a little bit behind technology-wise. All of our hotlines do not have a text aspect to them. We don't necessarily all use technology in ways that might be helpful to survivors who are really counting on those ways to connect. But that also requires funding and education.
Eve Sheedy, intimate partner violence consultant, former executive director of the LA County Domestic Violence Council. Eve, thanks for coming on and talking to us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, meet the guy who's taking information from a camera in space and locating folks here in SoCal who aren't really following the outdoor watering drought rules. See, things are really dry around here, and it can see whose yard is wet. That's tomorrow on Greater LA. Visit the website, by the way, at kcrw.com/GLA. Tell us how you're doing. Give us some story ideas. Subscribe to the podcast, too, all at kcrw.com/GLA. You can get the podcast wherever you get them. And after all, you don't have to find a radio or the app at 2:30 and 6. You can listen when you want by downloading the Greater LA podcast. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthew, Rebecca Ludman, Sonia Geis, Jay Siebel, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordall all made this evening's episode possible. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great night.